In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Tuesday, November 4th, 2014. I'm handling the show on my own today. I'm going to do what I said I was going to do yesterday. And I can't believe I'm doing this in a certain way, but I think you guys will understand that there's a larger purpose here. I'm not really trying to settle an argument in a Facebook thread. It's that this argument I thought was interesting enough that it deserved a reply, just because generally speaking, it would be good to have answers to these sorts of arguments that come up so often. The kinds of claims that I think are sometimes thoughtlessly made by people who support the state. And I don't mean that people who support the state are all stupid or anything like that, but that sometimes they repeat arguments that sound obvious to them because it's never occurred to them that the arguments could be questioned. It's never occurred to them that there could be more than one way to think about it. Before I go on, a word from our sponsor. Who's our sponsor? Real Dissent, of course, the new Tom Woods book. Real Dissent, a libertarian sets fire to the index card of allowable opinion, with all kinds of juicy stuff about war and foreign policy and the free market and the Federal Reserve and depressions and Ron Paul and all kinds of fun stuff, all kinds of arguments you can use when you're in this situation, when people are giving you a hard time about being a libertarian. This will help you to navigate those discussions. There is a section of the book where I've taken a whole bunch of the smashes that I've done of articles against libertarianism, and I've brought them all together in one place. If you guys like those, then you'll really enjoy this book, Real Dissent. Find out about it at realdissent.com. Three websites to give you. Realdissent.com. You can get the audiobook version with me reading it via tomwoodsaudio.com. If you haven't used that yet, you're entitled to one free audiobook through that offer. There are several of my books available there, but the only one that I read myself is Real Dissent. So you can check that out at tomwoodsaudio.com. And of course, I appreciate deeply all you guys who help make the show possible as supporting listeners. So you guys all get the Kindle edition as part of your membership as a supporting listener. So check that out at supportinglisteners.com. All right, back to the program. I'm not going to give away any names. You know, this isn't about names. Isn't about trying to make people look bad or anything like that. No. We want to stick with the ideas. So this particular Facebook discussion began with a discussion of income inequality and stuff like that, and then it just spiraled into all kinds of other topics. And I was tagged in this thread at one point. And I'm afraid that by answering this, I'm going to be encouraging you guys to do that, to tag me in a discussion. Maybe Woods will do an episode on it. Look, ain't no way. That is it. This is my quota. My quota is one. That's it. So I don't want to cover every single issue because that'll take absolutely forever, but it began with this type of claim by, we'll just call him Jeff because that is his name. His name is Jeff. It began with his claim that, look, you can't take credit for all your success. A lot of your success is due to the government. If it weren't for the government, where would you be? And it is sort of the typical, if it weren't for the government, it's just the sort of shtick that I usually do. If it weren't for the government, you'd be eating poison sandwiches and your kids would be in a coal mine and everybody's limbs would be blown off by exploding computer monitors and all that. It's the standard view. And again, I understand why people have that view. I'd be shocked if anybody got out of school with a view other than that. But he says, I likely owe at least 20% of my success to the support my government has given me, perhaps 30%. I owe the rest of my fellow citizens that to help ensure that the next generation gets the same benefits I have enjoyed. Then he goes on to say, it is in my best interest to live in a country with well-educated citizens ones who receive enough assistance to keep from starving to death, and then goes on and on. So let's stop right there. There are so many presuppositions here. There are so many assumptions, unexamined assumptions, to the point where I don't think he even realizes that these arguments need to be defended. They can't merely be asserted. Now, it is a little difficult to know exactly where to begin with an argument like this. I could just talk about education, for example, and say that I actually think the government's educational system produces, well, generations of ignoramuses, and each one is worse than the previous one. I mean, if government had nothing to do with education, and education was provided entirely by Walmart and Amazon, which this guy hates completely, he would be complaining, he would be up in arms, we'd never hear the end of it, of the shoddy product that's produced by Walmart and Amazon education, right? We would never hear the end of it. These kids know nothing about anything. They have major confusions about fundamental historical events. They can barely understand what the concept of 75% means. We would never hear the end of it. But because of the double standard that we so often see on the part of people who give the benefit of the doubt to government, well, to the contrary, government education is what makes all your opportunities possible. Where would you be without government education? Well, as we've noted on this program, England became the most literate society on the face of the earth with an entirely private education system. As we've seen in two separate episodes on this program, it turns out that around the world, in the poorest countries, students are being educated in low-cost private schools that are vastly less expensive than the government-run schools and have vastly better outcomes. Now, if that's the case, how can you justify expropriating people to fund an inferior alternative? Now, as we'll see later, this Jeff supports pretty much every federal agency there is because his elected representatives decided that these things were necessary. It really is discouraging that somebody would have such a naive confidence in people who deserve it so little. Well, these are my wise elected representatives, and they decided that these federal agencies are necessary. And these federal agencies all have nice names, right? So they must be doing what their name indicates that they must be doing. And I support that. What he doesn't seem to realize is that in case after case, these agencies, or whether it's could be the educational system in a state or it could be some federal agency, they all wind up as fiefdoms looking to expand their own power and wealth and benefits at the expense of the rest of the public. And yes, that's even true of the sacred education bureaucracy. You guys have probably heard me tell the story of John Chubb, the Brookings Institution researcher, who after 13 telephone calls was finally able to get the New York City public school system to tell him that there were 6,000 bureaucrats in their central office. Then he calls the Archdiocese of New York, which educates 1/6 as many students, wants to know how many bureaucrats are in their central office. They should have 1,000 proportionately. First person answers the phone, says, "I'm sorry, I don't know how many. Let me count." The answer turns out to be 26. So this is why we can't have this inexcusable confidence in these bureaucracies, or think that this is just an accident, or it doesn't have to be the case that these bureaucracies all work this way. It doesn't have to be the case that they're obviously self-interested, and they are obviously aiming at their own well-being rather than at the general public's well-being. This is how they have to work. This is the incentive structure within which they operate. They have to work this way. So yes, we want to minimize or eliminate the extent to which we rely on this kind of model for the provision of services that we want. Now, it says here that it's in my best interest to live in a country with well-educated citizens, and so, you know, I'm going to pay my taxes so as to make that possible. And I need to pay back what was done for me and all this and that. Well, I don't use the government school systems because I think they're an atrocity. I think what's taught in them is appalling. The behavior of the kids when they get out of them is just beyond words. They have all kinds of problems, egalitarianism and all kinds of problems with them. Now, I'm able to educate my kids in a very good private school. So would I be able to get a tax refund then, since I am actually working to have my kids educated and I'm not relying on any government money? I'm not relying on Jeff to pay for my kids' education. It would never occur to me to ask Jeff to pay for my kids' education. Could I get a little bit of financial consideration? No, of course not. Of course not. We've decided that this is the system. It's a system that will teach things that maybe run deeply contrary to everything you believe, but we're going to confiscate your money and put your kids in there, whether you like it or not, more or less. You know, it's so easy to talk about the separation of church and state. You know, oh, I deeply believe in the separation of church and state. Very easy to say that because the whole world believes in that. And the reason you believe in the separation of church and state is that you believe that nobody should be forced to participate in or pay for something he does not believe in. That's a good general principle. So then why does it not apply to the government schools? I deeply oppose what they teach in the vast majority of those schools. And I have an overwhelming abundance of evidence for my position as against theirs. So therefore, shouldn't I be exempted? You are deeply violating my conscience. Ah, well, it turns out that violating your conscience is only a problem when it's things that I, the government supporter, disagree with. I disagree with churches being funded. So that shouldn't be done. That's a terrible violation of conscience. But I do believe in the new American churches and the new American priesthood, namely the government school system. And so, no, sorry, there's no opting out of that. So you're no better than people who wanted government funding and government support of churches. You are upholding exactly the same principle, except you think, but my principle's really good and important. Yeah, and they thought the same thing. So you're no different. And likewise, the superstitious reverence toward my elected representatives is a bit much for me, because I think I hear this from people who like to laugh at people who went along with monarchy. Oh, who could be so superstitious as to go along with monarchy? Ho, 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 we're so much more sophisticated than that. And yet these very people have the same superstitious reverence toward elected representatives. Well, my elected representatives decided that we needed to go incinerate all those innocent people. And, you know, hey, if you don't like it, vote for different elected representatives. How is that different from somebody who says, well, the king thinks we should be at war with Ruritania, so I guess that must be God's will and that must be the right thing to do? It's exactly the same thing. It's the same superstition dressed up in different clothing. That's all it is. Now, if this guy thinks he owes his fellow citizens 20, 30% of his income, then why doesn't he just go and give his fellow citizens that portion of his income? Why doesn't he look up some reputable charities that have a good track record, unlike the U.S. government, which brags about how many people it puts on its rolls? An actual charity brags about how many people it has taken off its rolls and given productive lives to. Why doesn't he find those people? Why doesn't he find those institutions? Why does he say, no, really, I want you to steal from me. I want you to come and confiscate this money. I mean, that seems deeply irresponsible to me. And it goes to show what a cold and unfeeling relationship the state encourages us to have with our fellow man. Instead of actually going out and helping actual flesh and blood people, this guy thinks it's enough that the government takes a portion of his paycheck. That's it. That's all I need to do. I just give these people some money, and I'm sure they're going to do what's right with it. What possible interest would they have to do what's right with that money? What possible interest would any agency of the government ever have to do what's right? Its incentive is to fail, because the more it fails, the more money it gets. Exactly the opposite of the private sector, of which this person is, not surprisingly, so suspicious. And yes, there are people who think it is immoral for a group of people, I don't care whether they're elected or not, what on earth moral difference does that make? I don't care if whether they're elected or who they are. But that a group of people decides that we think you should all be taxed at 50%, or we think that this should be taxed and that should be taxed. And I mean, if you think of all the different taxes you pay, it's not just income tax and withholding tax and sales tax, but also hotels and parking and cable. And I mean, it is everywhere. Taxation is absolutely everywhere. These people think that that is a morally acceptable way to fund themselves. But, you know, as Michael Humer has said on this show, we wouldn't think that, it's acceptable to go around saying, look, I have a really good charity, so I'm just going to hold you up at gunpoint because it's really important to fund my charity. We would all say that's wrong. Well, it doesn't become magically right because the people enforcing it wear official-looking hats and uniforms. Either we believe in moral principles or we don't. And, of course, remember Robert Nozick's famous Tale of the Slave. Nozick was the well-known Harvard philosopher who, and I'm giving a very, very much stripped-down version of it. I talk about it in my book Rollback a bit. But the argument he uses is, let's suppose you got a bunch of slaves living on a plantation, and they're overseen by a cruel master. And then let's say one day the master announces that from now on he's not going to whip them anymore. Well, good, but they're still slaves, so we're not really getting to the heart of the problem here. Well, what if he says, well, you know what? How about this? Not only will I not whip you, but you only have to work 5 days a week. Take the weekend off. Be a chattel slave 5 days a week. We would again say, you know, I think you're just not seeing what's wrong with this relationship. Now, what if he said, you know what? Hey, how about this? You only have to work 4 days a week. 4 days a week as a slave. You see, that wouldn't really be the issue. Now, what if he says, how about this? I will let you come and go as you please. I will send you out into the world, okay? I'll send you out into the world. You don't even have to be directly my slave anymore. You don't have to work for me anymore. All we have to do is make sure that when you go out there, you have to send me 3 days' worth of the fruits of your labor. You have to send it back to me in the form of a check. I don't care what work you do. You can choose your job. You can do anything you want as long as you send me that check for the equivalent of 3 days of your labor. Well, Nozick says, well, at what point did this stop being the tale of a slave? The same principle is obviously still in effect in the entire relationship. And it's not enough to say, well, some people voted for this guy. What moral difference would that make? Again, as Michael Humer said on this very show, if you go out for drinks with your friends and all your friends vote that you should pay for the drinks, you don't have to pay for the drinks. That doesn't, there's no moral consideration there that a bunch of people say you should do something. Well, we believe in something called rights, and you can't use violence against me, forcing me to do things against my will just because a bunch of you want me to do it. A bunch of people have wanted people to do all kinds of terrible things over the centuries. Then in terms of welfare programs, which he also supports, what have been the results of this? Trillions of dollars spent and basically nothing to show for it. As I've noted numerous times, practically all the progress against poverty that's taken place around the world and in the United States occurred long before there was any welfare state worth speaking of. And we're told today the free market can't possibly alleviate poverty as we walk around living in luxury, a kind of luxury that no one at any time or place in the history of the world could conceivably have imagined. We're so blind to this that we're going around complaining about the very system that made it possible. But think of it this way. In order to get money to the poor through the government, I did some calculations in my book, Rollback, and it turns out that you need $5 to get just $1 to the poor because of the deadweight losses associated with taxation and because of the overhead of the welfare bureaucracies. $5 turns into only $1 for them. Any complaining about this? I doubt Jeff even knew that. And, of course, why would he? Because he just takes at face value that the government says it's helping the poor, so it must be. Meanwhile, all kinds of opportunities for the poor are foreclosed by various government cartel arrangements through special occupational licensing and wage restrictions and so on, limiting the ability of the poor to get to the first rung of the ladder. You know, I mean, I have no doubt this guy supports the minimum wage. And in the 60s, you can even see people saying the minimum wage is a way to protect good white northern workers against black southern competition. They just came right out and said that. There's no excuse to pretend that you just have good intentions and you just want to help the most vulnerable. You are obviously harming the most vulnerable when you decide that the way to help the poor is to look at all their lists, their list of all their options, and then eliminate the option they actually chose. How could that make them better off? And then, of course, as I show in both in Rollback and in the government course that I did for the Ron Paul Homeschool Program, ronpaulhomeschool.com, of course, and you can get my courses, suitable for adults, by the way, at tomwoodshomeschool.com, is that there's a problem that Charles Murray identified a long time ago, an incentive problem faced by these sorts of programs. And that is, it's a fact of human nature that people are inclined to go after the things that they need to get the things that they want using the least possible exertion. And as you begin to make your payments or programs more and more generous for people who are in very unfortunate circumstances, well, more and more people now have an incentive to put themselves in those unfortunate circumstances and to become antisocial, to devote themselves to thinking of how they can wind up with a share of the money instead of thinking, well, how can I please my fellow man? How can I come up with something that improves his life in some way? And thereby it encourages a self-destructive culture of, yes, welfare dependency. There is such a thing. I've seen this so many times in my life. I have seen people so twisted and deformed by the welfare mentality. Opportunities are right in front of their faces, but they spurn them repeatedly. They're waiting for the dream job to come along. And yet they could stand some of the discipline of the market to say, no, you've got to get out there and take what you can get because that's the first rung of the ladder. Well, then Jeff says, if you want to live without that immorality, because the other person had said it's immoral to go around taking people's things on the pretext that we're going to do nice things with them, he says, I suggest you find a nice desert island and start growing and hunting your own food. So two things here. Number one, he thinks that if you don't believe in being violently expropriated, then you don't believe in social cooperation. But indeed, we're the only ones who do believe in social cooperation. We're the ones who believe in cooperation, which means no violence, right? It means that we figure out ways to make things work voluntarily by cooperating with each other and not just thinking of each other as cash cows to be milked. I don't really think of that as cooperation. I think of that as exploitation. And then secondly, of course, he's also implying, and more than implies, he later expressly says that if you don't like our rules, why don't you get out? But this seems like a strange moral principle. Why should I be the one who has to leave? Shouldn't it be the people who are going around demanding that other people cough up? Shouldn't it be the ones who are threatening violence against peaceful people? Why shouldn't they leave? I was here first. I was here before people decided on these rules. And of course, they didn't decide on these rules. They decided to vote for some people who came up with some self-interested rules that they then persuaded the public were really for the general welfare. It's the usual trick. But why should I be the one who has to leave? For example, again, Michael Humer says, suppose the mafia took over your town. Okay, let's suppose the mafia comes in and takes over your town. And you say, no, I'm sorry, I'm not paying you. And they say, well, look, you're still sticking around. I mean, we just repaved the roads. Apparently you like the roads, so I guess you've consented. You know, Roderick Long says, suppose one of your neighbors starts dumping trash on your lawn and you don't immediately move away. Does that mean that you have no right to complain when he keeps dumping trash on your lawn? Because after all, you've consented. I mean, this idea of tacit consent, or you really consented, even though we didn't actually ask you, but we just, for the sake of starting the looting process, had to assume that you consented. And if you don't consent, well, then you can go live on a desert island so we can get away with continuing to exploit people. This, I think, begs all the relevant moral questions. Moreover, how was I able to indicate my non-consent? Was there any way that I could have said, no, I don't consent to this, other than leaving? I mean, presumably we're not going to take that seriously as an option, that I should have to leave because other people want to bully me. And yeah, they voted to bully me. wow, that makes it totally acceptable. They voted to bully me, so I should be the one who has to leave. If there's no way for me to indicate my lack of consent, then this is not really a thing. You know, this is not really a system. And then he goes on to talk about all the benefits that you get from being here. Do I have the option of not getting them? Was I ever given the possibility of having competing providers of these services? If I had been given that option, and yet I continued to use the government services, he would have a better claim. But I've never been given an option. I've never been given the choice of competing services. So the fact that by virtue of living, I have to use the government services obviously doesn't prove anything, unless the whole thing is just a farce. Then he says, one of the greatest freedoms this country affords you is the freedom to leave at will if you find our system immoral. Oh my. One of the greatest freedoms is to leave. So in other words, we're going to expropriate you. We're going to use that money to bomb all kinds of innocent people repeatedly in wars that are based on obvious lies. Lies that we're laughing about behind closed doors. And if you have any moral objection to that, you're free to leave. It's one of the greatest freedoms we have. Now, he does have a discussion of monopoly and the free market benefits the big businesses and all that. We've covered that a lot on this show. We had a whole episode on the myths of antitrust. Turns out antitrust is one of the least defensible things government does, even though you think it must be one of the most defensible, because without it, we'd have monopolies everywhere. But he raises predatory pricing. We dealt with that in our episode recently with Tom DiLorenzo. I won't address his claim that he says, you may think that some of these programs are unconstitutional, but not according to our foremost constitutional experts, the Supreme Court. So this is a group of political appointees, and yet he believes these to be our foremost constitutional experts. A group of political appointees are the greatest experts we have. Well, I'd say greater experts than they are would be the people at the state ratifying conventions, who again and again repeatedly said the federal government would have only the powers expressly delegated to them. I don't care how much of an expert you are. You're coming up against that brick wall, which invalidates the vast majority of what the federal government does. Oh, and our wonderful constitutional experts, the Supreme Court, who brought you the principle that you don't really have freedom of speech when it comes to speaking out against war, and you can be thrown in jail for years and years afterward, or that you can be drafted into the military, that you, even though Daniel Webster said it was absolutely unconstitutional to be drafted into the military, that, no, of course you can, because look, Russia does it, Japan does it. I mean, that was the argument in the selective draft law cases. That was the argument by our foremost constitutional experts who said, sure, you can incarcerate the Japanese Americans if you want to. I mean, you could just go on and on and on. And if you don't like them, then you can what? Vote them out? You can't. But finally, I mean, this could just go on forever, but he says, I'm glad we do have welfare programs, which have, again, accomplished nothing in terms of statistical aggregates. They have accomplished nothing. Federal Reserve, income tax. So he's glad we have the income tax. Of course he is. But he's glad we have the Federal Reserve. Now, he never elaborates on this. So he's glad that we have an institution that prolonged World War I, that prolonged the Vietnam War, that has been the most welcome addition to the American warfare state. He's all in favor of that. Now, he would never put it that way, because as a progressive, I'm sure he's never made the connection between the Federal Reserve and war. But you got to think. You know, you can't just spend your life repeating government press releases. At some point, you have to have an independent thought. You have to put these things next to each other and say, you know, maybe the one leads to the other. I don't like the warfare state. Maybe the Fed has a little something to do with that. You have to think about this. I mean, of course, the way the military-industrial complex works is a classic case of how the government does not behave in the interests of the general public. I've got, I don't know how many examples in my book Rollback of just ordinary day-to-day operation of the government and how it does not operate. And it's not like I found three little exposés. No, this is in the very incentive structure by which the government operates, that it must behave this way. It is exploiting, expropriating, and looting people every single day, making people poorer every single day in multiple ways. And then we have people like this who just accept at face value everything they're doing. If the private sector did half of these things, we'd never hear the end of it. But here it's like Stockholm syndrome. It really is like a society-wide Stockholm syndrome. But also, I see no acknowledgement at all that there's even a theory that the Federal Reserve contributes to economic fluctuations. I mean, might there be some consequences to artificially manipulating interest rates? Like, why would that not have consequences? Interest rates arise from voluntary interactions on the free market. Why would there not be consequences to that when you interfere with that? Well, of course, there's a whole school of thought consisting of a Nobel Prize-winning economist, F.A. Hayek, who argues that that's indeed what causes the fluctuations, that as in the case of the Great Depression, which we got courtesy of the Fed, you have the boom period in which interest rates are made artificially low. And as I've shown in a lot of my videos and in my book Meltdown on the Financial Crisis and on this show as well, this creates this seems to be prosperity, but actually the economy is being arranged in an unsustainable configuration. And eventually the recession is where the economy catches up with all this artificiality. And meanwhile, people are thrown out of work. There's all kinds of dislocation. The Fed has something to do with that. But yet I would be very willing to bet that this Jeff has never even heard of the Austrian theory of the business cycle. Not that he's heard it, evaluated the claims, and then rejected them. He's never heard it, partly because he's just not open to it. It's really now, this day and age, it's all around you. You can read about it, you hear about it all the time, because he's inclined to give the benefit of the doubt to existing institutions, which is the very opposite of the spirit of progressivism, which is supposed to hold existing institutions up to constant scrutiny. Then finally, he admits that the two major parties don't really have the public's well-being at heart. Oh, well, how about that? Really? You mean the two parties that both supported the bailouts, both support the wars, both support the Fed, both support the military-industrial complex? You mean these people don't have the general public's interests at heart? Yeah, no kidding. Then he says, well, maybe we could have some election reform, and that would solve the problem. Look, if you have an institution with the power to grab as much of the people's wealth as it thinks it can get away with, if you have an institution that has the power to initiate violence against people, and all it has to do is put some kind of public welfare veneer on top of it, if it has the power to throw young kids in cages because they consumed the wrong thing, what possible election reform is going to fix that? Everybody, every sociopath in society wants access to that. Every person who doesn't want to make a living making other people happy, but instead just wants free stuff, wants special privileges, wants special subsidies, wants artificially low interest rates, wants bailouts, is going to favor this institution, and they're going to get what they want one way or the other, all the pitiful election reforms to the contrary notwithstanding. So, in short, think. Don't just repeat propaganda that's fed to you by people who stand to grow quite wealthy and powerful if you believe in that propaganda. All right, everybody, that's it for today. You can undo the propaganda that you and I were both taught in school. Let's face it, we were both taught it in history or in economics or in philosophy. You can unlearn it at mylibertyclassroom.com in courses taught by me and by people I trust. And I am giving away just through tomorrow, this is a short-term offer, I'm giving away hard copies of my new book, Real Dissent. If you don't want to join LibertyClassroom.com, get Real Dissent through RealDissent.com, but join LibertyClassroom.com, drop me a line through the contact page with your mailing address, and say, hey, you bum, I just joined. I can't believe I've got 11 and soon 12 courses to go through at my leisure. Plus, I can ask you guys all the questions I want. I am so deliriously happy I can barely type out my mailing address, and you send that to me. All right, tomorrow we're going to talk to Michael Bolden about what happened on Election Day with respect to nullification and the 10th Amendment. Then it's Bert Folsom on FDR and World War II. And then finally, law professor Butler Schaefer will join us. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.